Comics Podcast with the Rotoscopers, Episode 61, Last Unicorn. Give us more Pirate Cat!
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. You can download any of 100,000 audiobooks and more and listen on your Kindle, tablet, iPhone, iPod, and Android. Head on over to rotoscopers.com/audible and you can download The Last Unicorn. You can listen to the unabridged version narrated by the author himself. What a deal! Head on over to rotoscopers.com/audible for your free audiobook.
Welcome to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers. Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, Don Bluth, Rankin Bass, and everything in between. I am your host, Mason Smith, the one and only, and today I'm riding solo, representing the males, because I am outnumbered 3-1 today. So, just want to introduce our awesome co-hosts, Morgan Stradling and Chelsea Robson.
And presenting the one and only, Miss Whitney Grace!
Hi, everyone! I'm sorry, they're just making me laugh so hard that my voice might sound a little strange.
Welcome to the podcast, Whitney.
For those of you who don't know, Whitney Grace, she is a writer for AnimatedViews.com, and she's also the host of our new podcast, the Animation Interviews Podcast. So if you said, I know that voice, if we're not talking about the documentary, it's because you recognize Whitney Grace from Animation Interviews, where she does a wonderful job. So we're glad, and she's particularly fond of The Last Unicorn, so we invited her on today.
Well, thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making Just keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Bra Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Bravo, bros.
Good job.
So this is the start of what we're calling our horse series. We just decided let's do a bunch of horse animated films in a row. So the first one we're doing is The Last Unicorn. And we're kind of going to cover like the three main categories of horses that you may see in My Little Pony and whatnot. You got unicorns, pegasi, and the land ponies, or as most people call them, just horses. So today we're talking about one of those, which is a unicorn. And this is probably one of the only animated films whose main character is a unicorn, The Last Unicorn.
Unless you're talking about Unico from Japan.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Oh, yeah.
The little baby unicorn. I forgot. See, this is why we have Whitney on the show. She's super, not scriptorian. What's the word? Animatorian?
I'm scriptorian.
Yes, Chelsea's a scriptorian.
She's well-versed.
Yes.
Why, thank you.
So one reason we chose this is because we got an email from one of our listeners named Zora personally requesting that we do this movie. So I'm just going to read a little bit of her email because she had some good thoughts about The Last Unicorn. She says, to the Rotoscopers, hello, my name is Zora, not my real name, and I want to praise you guys for taking the time to create such a marvelous podcast and website. I've been searching for a while for an animation podcast that reviews American animation with the same knowledge and attention to detail that I have found with anime podcasts. I never thought I would find an animation podcast that would mirror the love I have for animated cartoons also. You are clearly very respectful and knowledgeable of the medium, and I enjoy listening to your conversations. I do not know if I should be frightened or proud that I understand all of your references and tangents. Yes! I am writing to you.
I think she should be proud of how much she's frightened.
The Last Unicorn is a very special movie to me because it is the first movie I remember liking, although not the first movie I saw, and the movie that inspired me to be an animator. In college, I wrote a film analysis of the film based on my senior project cartoon on how it looked. I would also like for you to review it because the author of the book is currently going around the United States on a book and film tour, and I would like more people to be aware of this fact. The tour has not come around anywhere near me, unfortunately. Fair warning, you may not like this movie if you have never seen it before, because you are all very happy people. I showed the movie to my friends, and they did not like it for the fact that it was very depressing. I guess I was a depressed child to have liked it so much, but to me, the movie is about faith and looking past the everyday in order to see the magical all around us. I think the art direction in the movie is also very beautiful. Is it a perfect movie? No, but I think it has a place in the pantheon of animated films. I would go on and on about the film, but I will let you judge for yourselves. But thank you so much for taking the time to read my letter, and I hope you will consider reviewing The Last Unicorn. I will continue to enjoy your podcast, and I am very grateful for the work you put in each week, Zora.
Little does she know that the happiness of us all, we all loved this movie. Well, at least I did.
We overcame the depression.
No, for whatever reason, this really was one of my favorite movies growing up, and I have no idea why, because it is really dark, and it is very, I guess now I could think about it as thought-provoking, but at the time, I don't know why I was crazy enough to like this movie as a six-year-old, but it really was cool for me.
Yeah. Well, it kind of is this weird conundrum. It's got a 58% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, but the viewer rating is 82%, which unless I got my tomatoes mixed up, that means that 82% of viewers who were willing to rate the show gave it a high score, and so the people who've seen it really like it, but with critics it's got mixed reviews. So, I mean, that seems about right. This definitely seems like one of those animated films that has a cult following. Speaking of cults, this film was released in 1982, but I will heretofore refer to it as a 70s or 70s style film because I feel like there was enough of that late 70s in it to make it a 70s film. So let's say it's an 80s film with a 70s perspective on things. Bada boom, bada bing. What was really fun for me was hearing the voices of Jeff Bridges and Sir Christopher Lee. Probably not Sir Christopher Lee yet, and this is probably before he started the rock band. And Angela Lansbury. It's fun to hear those voices from, like, way back when. Like, a young Jeff Bridges, a younger Christopher Lee, and Angela Lansbury. So that was pretty cool. I think there were a couple of moderately notable people in the film, but I can't pinpoint them.
So what are your guys' first recollections of this movie, since this seems to be a childhood classic for many of us?
Well, I first got to watch this movie back in the really early 90s, I mean, right just out of the 80s. My parents and I were at a video store, and I couldn't find anything to watch. I mean, I swear we were there for at least an hour or two, at least in my small childlike mind. Then my dad tapped me on the shoulder, and he showed me the VHS, The Last Unicorn, and I knew my eyes just rotted, and I was like, mine, give me! And I was just going through that horse phase at that time. When we spent the rest of the evening watching the movie, and we were eating vanilla ice cream with nuts in it. And I honestly think little kids, I mean, I didn't fully comprehend what was going on. I just loved the animation, the unicorn, but I don't think little kids will be able to fully understand the message of the movie.
Yeah, that's very true. I didn't understand a word of it when I was a kid. But I did know that it was trying to tell me something, which maybe that's the reason why I like the artsy feel to it. I don't know.
Yeah, myself, this is the first time of me watching it. I only watched a few handful of Rankin Bass 2D animated films, like the claymation stuff I got loads of as a youth, and so, I guess it was different for me having seen it for the first time just the other night.
See, that's good that we have quite a range of perspectives here.
Yeah, I'm still a little weirded out by it, but we'll get to that.
I actually saw this movie in college, so Chelsea and I got together. I went to school at BYU in Provo, and Chelsea has a sister who lives up there. So during my first or second semester, I think it was the first semester, Chelsea came and visited. And so we had kind of a sleepover at her sister's house, aka her sister's mansion. And I'm not even joking, her sister has a basketball court in her house. And so we were watching this movie, and I'd never seen it before, but Chelsea was really gung-ho as Chelsea gets, which is very gung-ho, about watching this movie. So I was like, okay, whatever. And I just remember thinking it was cool. We loved animation, so we were excited to watch it. But then her sister later, like, I remember her kind of, like, reprimanding us, being like, aren't you guys too old for this? Like, why are you watching a movie like that? And I'm like, ugh. And so continued the let's get defensive about animation because it's not for kids stance that I have taken ever since I was, you know, young.
Oh, she, like, what's great is, like, she's such a huge fan of the fact that we do this podcast nowadays. So she's like, hey, that's great. But yeah, back in the day, she was didn't quite know what to do with me.
I was like, this is why you're not married. Just kidding.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Like, that really doesn't make sense if both of you guys are married now. Whatever.
I'm still thankful.
Hey. Okay, so apparently, see, it has nothing to do with the animation. There we go.
Okay, good.
Okay, so let's talk about the production of this film.
So we've done Rankin Bass episodes before, but is this the first time we've done one of their animated films? ...
No, yeah, I don't think we've ever done one of their full-length films at all.
Yeah, so to me, Rankin Bass is like this kind of... Yeah.
Ready, Santa.
I just had to open that up again.
I want to be a dentist.
Anyway, so yeah, Rankin Bass Productions, as far as the 2D... So let me backtrack. So when I finished watching this film, I was like, golly, all these animators and the credits are Japanese, and this whole thing looks kind of like a proto-anime half Rankin Bass thing, and so I did a little research, of course, and you know, Rankin Bass isn't like, to me, it's not like the most amazing studio or groundbreaking, but they sure put out a lot of stuff, and for that I think they're responsible for a ton of my childhood memories, like animation wise because I mean, they got all those claymation films, you know, and all those animated like holiday films that you'd like watch in elementary school.
Yeah.
You know, in class, like, that was pretty much all Rankin Bass, like, Cricket on the Hearth, you know, Santa Claus is coming to town. Did they do the Easter Bunnies come into town? Because I know it's a thing, but I don't know Rankin Bass did it. Anyway, yeah, so, like, a ton of my childhood kind of belongs to Rankin Bass. And so, what do y'all think about, like, Rankin Bass as a whole, I guess?
I've always been a huge fan of Rankin Bass. I think mostly just because they, like so many of these smaller companies, they've really been able to define what their style is. And so many people, like, they bounce around from style to style, and you don't really know.
I agree with Chelsea there. Smaller studios are also able to experiment with different stories that usually wouldn't make it with a bigger studio. The larger studios are more money-driven, while the smaller studios are kind of also just want to do the art for art's sake thing.
Something that's interesting that we're doing this movie now is Arthur Rankin Jr., he died on this year, on January 31st, at the age of 89.
Huh. Oh, my gosh.
Jules Bass is still alive, so we still have one half of the team.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of the names Rankin and Bass, there actually is a official website, rankinbass.com. I tried to do some research by checking the website out, but my gosh, This is an official Mason Smith shout out or a plea for help. Or a plea for change on Rankin Bass. Please update your website. Like, we don't use Windows 95s anymore.
Yeah,
I say that in the nicest way, but the website needs some design and format changes. I couldn't even read anything that I was looking at. But you know what? If Mr. Rankin if Jules Bass is listening to this podcast right now, then you know, my brother-in-law is a great graphic designer, and he can probably help you out with your website. I think it would definitely get y'all more attention from animation fans if you improved your website. That's just me. I'm just going to back off there. Leave it at that. Yeah, the website.
Seriously, it's like time traveling back into 1997. You remember the Space Jam website that used to just be like a time capsule? Well, apparently they updated it, so you can't go to spacejam.com anymore and experience 1995 in all its glory. But this, you can. So check out rankinbass.com because it's pretty awesome. The Last Unicorn is based on the book by Peter S. Beagle, which we've mentioned, and it basically follows the same premise, right?
I have read the original novel by Peter S. Beagle. I'm a researcher. I always go back to the original source material.
That's why we have you here. I'm so glad.
This is special. But anyway, Peter S. Beagle's novel has less personal an effect. You don't get really much into the characters' minds or understanding what exactly they want. Some people might disagree with me, but it reads more like a medieval epic. Now, the movie, I feel, adds more of a personal touch where you get to know the characters better and you actually empathize with them more. And Peter S. Beagle was closely linked to writing the script of Rankin and Bass Studios. He said that it was really close to his first drafts and what he intended with the movie.
Very cool.
Good stuff.
I like the term you used. What is it? Medieval epic? Fantasy epic? Or something like that? Because it definitely has one of those kind of Odyssey-type structures.
It does. It kind of, I think the most modern epic, medieval epic we're ever going to get, J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And when I was reading The Last Unicorn, I kept hearing Lord of the Rings echoing throughout my mind.
Yeah, definitely.
And ironically, and on a side note, Rankin and Bass also did animate Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
Yeah, they did. And Christopher Lee, who plays Saruman, is in this film. I kept thinking, I shall take the unicorn to Isengard. You know, that's what I was thinking. To war! Anyway. I still want to talk about the animation because it just was so weird to me that Lady Amalthea was very anime-ish in appearance. So it turns out the film was animated by a studio called Topcraft, which was they also did the animation for Nausicaa. I don't know what that means when there's two A's and there's a
Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind.
Nausicaa.
It's from the Odyssey.
Okay. Now, this Topcraft studio did the animation for Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind, which was a Miyazaki film, and from the 80s, which would explain the the anime-ish appearance of certain characters, and the rest of them were just pretty much hobbits. Topcraft itself was an offshoot of Toei Animation, which you might recognize in the credits for Dragon Ball Z and Digimon, for those of you who care about Digimon. Anyone? No, okay.
I didn't
think so.
Hey, I like that show.
Yeah, sorry. I guess we have a couple of Digimon fans. Digimon, we'll have to save Digimon versus everything, versus Pokemon for another time. But anyway, Toei Animation, they did a ton of animes, actually. But the most notable that I found were Dragon Ball Z and GT and just plain old Dragon Ball. And the Digimon series. From what I read, a lot of the Topcraft staffers would go on to either form or be part of Studio Ghibli when it was starting out, and thus animation immortality. So Rankin Bass has this like really weird connection to some of these top anime studios. And you know, and when it comes down to it, it's basically a trippy 1970s style fantasy story made in the 80s, animated by people who normally do animes. Did you follow off that?
I got it.
Excellent. Now, when I think Rankin Bass, I think rotoscoping. Like, yeah. I've seen clips from the Lord of the Rings. But mostly apart from the...
Yeah, mostly Lord of the Rings is what I think of.
Like that limping, the limping ring wraith when he comes, gets off his horse. Like, they traced a dude. But anyway. you know, apart from the first sequence with the two hunters, I didn't see a lot of, like, traditional 2D rotoscoping in this film, which is cool. To me, the animation as a whole was still hard for me to watch because it's so, like, dated and old. And maybe it's just Rankin-Bass's style, but, like, I had a problem with Rockadoodle for the same reason. I just felt like the animation was too rhythmic, and all the lines were on a were delivered on a pose-to-pose basis. Like, they would deliver a line, then they would change their pose, then they would say something else, then they would change their pose, and they would say something else. So if you look into the 12 principles of animation, to me, there was a lack of secondary motion going on, which is where a character is doing something apart, like he's performing an action apart and separate from his main action that just kind of not fills it in, but it makes their character more lifelike and interesting. And there was definitely an absence of this.
Drop the mic.
Boom. Mason hath spoken.
See, I agree too, but I think just if people were to never have seen this and look at the cover and just, because mostly it just features the unicorn, I think people would think it is an anime and they'd kind of be turned off, which is kind of a shame because I think people really should give this movie a chance.
Yeah. Well, Whitney's right. I don't really think that it's, that the animation style is like anime. I think some of the character designs are. I guess that's what I meant to say. Was it the unicorn and then Lady Amalthea?
Amethelia.
I'm sorry?
Lady Amethelia.
All right. Lady Amethelia. I just thought her character design resembled anime, but you're right. I mean, the animation itself is very American.
I have some of the greatest roommates ever. And one of my roommates, as I was going through telling her that the next podcast we're going to be doing was The Last Unicorn, she's like, oh, I have that on DVD. And my DVD's collection is very small right now. And so I was so excited. I was like, yay. And so as I'm going through, I'm watching some of the special features, and there's not a lot, you know, because, you know, most of these don't really have a lot. But, you know, there was one special feature of the author, and he's going through and he's talking about just the story of how he came up with the Last Unicorn. And I just thought it was really interesting because he talked about some of the different themes that he had in his book. And one of them, and so I'm just going to go through and talk about the main themes that that I never caught as a kid. But then after hearing that and then going back and watching the film, it really made the whole thing very thought-provoking for me. So do you guys want to hear it?
Yeah, sure.
Sounds like fun.
Yes! I'm just kidding.
Do you need a third confirmation? I think you're good to go.
No, my microphone went out. So I was waiting.
The Rotoscopers Council must vote unanimously.
One of the main themes is, he says, the difference between being alone and loneliness. Because for a long time, the unicorn... As long as the unicorn knows that there are others out there like her, she's fine and doesn't really care that she's alone. But the thing that frightens her the most is thinking that she is the last. And so that was one of those interesting questions. Like, what is the difference between being alone and loneliness? And then another one I have is, you don't know what you have until you let go.
Real quick, Chelsea, you know what you just said made me think of?
What?
Show me the meaning of being lonely. That's a Chinese mandarin instead of a Spanish guitar.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
You're welcome. Continue.
Okay. You don't know what you have until you let go. Smedrick spends the whole time trying to control his power, but it is only when he fully lets go that he realizes the hugeness of it. I kind of take this as more of a demonstration of faith versus wanting total control over everything. And then another one was the difference between the illusion and reality. You'll see this a lot through the film. Like, there's one part where he says that you don't have to see what you're looking at if you don't want to, or vice versa. Smedrick, he talks about it. He says it's a very rare person who's taken for who he really is. You got identity issues. And then you got the dashing Captain Cully and his band of free men. And he even goes in, he's like, magic is magic, but we are reality. And then everyone chases after the Robin Hood spell. So, like, I don't know. What are some of the... Did you catch any of these as you guys watched it?
Yeah, I did. When I was I've always thought about this reality thing with the thieves, Captain Cully and Molly Grew. I mean, that's still a theme I think about regularly when I'm ever thinking about animation. I think it's because this world is probably between reality and magic. I kind of think it's on the threshold of leaving magic behind, kind of like when the world became more science and less focused on mythology. And I think that this world is heading in that right direction, so they're leaving the magic and the mortals behind, so the immortals are retreating. And it feels like the end of the age throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, this is all really interesting, and I'm very glad that we're discussing this, because I didn't really see much in this film as far as, like, themes or messages. Like, I mean, I got the whole thing about, like, appearances and, like, deception and stuff, but I don't know. I just felt all the... I guess I couldn't get into the film to really... enough to really extract, like, a theme or a message. So, yeah, this is definitely helping. It's good.
It's the product of many, many viewings for them.
I know. I am but an initiate. I need to see it more times before I am enlightened.
He also goes in and talks about how there's a follow-up story called The Two Hearts, where Smedrick, Molly, King Lear, and the unicorn also make appearances. And it actually went on to win the Hugo Award. So that was pretty cool. Go ahead.
Wait, so was that like a... Was it like a novel or a play or what?
It's a short story.
Oh, that's what the Hugo Award's for. Okay. Because of the ending of this film, I would be interested in reading a follow-up story just to see what the heck happened to all these people.
Well, you'll have to check out Two Hearts.
Don't take my word for it. But yeah. So I talked about the opening sequence, the two hunters. I don't know. I think there's some pretty, like, depth of field kind of camera tricks when they're kind of going through certain, different layers of the animation going in and out of focus. So I liked that. Like, everything seems kind of very natural and very pretty, you know. And then, the hunters are like, hey, if you're out there, you're probably the last unicorn. See ya. You know, basically that's layman's terms. So, and then we open to the unicorn.
Yeah, so the I like that they introduce us to the unicorn at the very beginning, because the movie's titled The Last Unicorn, and then she's very clearly, the main character. But, she starts, this gets her thinking, am I the only unicorn there is? The last? I don't know, I don't like her first lines, because she sounds so aloof. And it's hard to take her seriously. She was voiced by Mia Farrow, but I don't know. I just feel that her first lines make it seem a bit aloof in my mind. But then she gains credibility later on. But I think she would fit perfectly in the My Little Pony Friendship is Magic universe. I would love to see a crossover cameo where she comes and visits, or she's in the background. Her design is so unique. I mean, she has some skinny, skinny legs, which really differentiates her from a lot of other horses that you've seen in animation. She's less realistic and more anime in her styling.
So we go from the unicorn, who's pretty interesting in herself, to, in my opinion, one of the most annoying characters ever, the butterfly. Mason's theory of the night is that the butterfly is a cautionary tale about the effects of methamphetamines on the brain. I bet he's like that in the book, but still.
Yeah.
very bizarre. It wasn't just bizarre, it was just tedious to listen to him. I'm like right there with the unicorn. Just spit it out! Wait, what was that about the Red Bull? Hey, go back to the Red Bull. Say that.
And he's like, blah, 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 blah.
Like, all right, worst. We're done here. Where's that can of Raid I had with me?
Well, here's the thing about the butterfly. Their mentality, since they're so busy fluttering from flower to flower, is that it's very hard for them to focus. And so since they fly around a lot, they also pick up a lot of different things. So that's why he sounds like he has ADD.
Or I thought LSD. He was out of place. Compared to all the other characters in this movie, he was so like the genie from Aladdin, just, you know, snappy and has these one-liners, really funny. And then the rest of the movie was pretty solemn. So he never comes back. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, he should have been the guy to sing the song at the end, you know, like Arabian Night. You know. He should have come back, but I guess he didn't. I mean, he went and pollinated another book? I don't know. But anyway, so he is the one who kind of pulls like an Inception kind of thing and puts the idea of this Red Bull driving all the unicorns into the sea. The lonely unicorn goes from alone to lonely. And in the moral of the story is clearly stated is that Red Bull does not give you wings. Red Bull is evil and bad.
You mean this wouldn't turn her into a Pegasus?
No, it would turn her into an alicorn.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Oh, brother.
I love alicorns.
Mason, I'm actually just as lost as you are in this conversation.
They're talking about My Little Pony.
I know that.
That
but
term
I
didn't come from My Little Pony, by
no,
the way.
It came from other fantasy stories.
Yeah, see? It's
probably
real.
I don't know. Maybe the moral of the story is to go organic with engineering? I don't know. Vitamin V? Anyway, I don't know where this Red Bull came from. Do you guys have a clue?
I do. How we got the idea to do a Red Bull?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, his brother-in-law was an artist in Spain, and he, for whatever reason, decided to do a painting of a bull fighting a unicorn. And so when he saw this picture that his brother-in-law did, he was so entranced by it that he's like, I love this. This is what my story shall be about. And that's how it came about.
Okay, I'll take it. And so with this starts this like weird string of rules, magic rules. For one, like, so there's a deal. The unicorn never leaves. No, it's bad luck to hunt in a unicorn's forest. But if the unicorn leaves this forest, then it's like a big deal. It means that they can lose their aura of protection. Anyway, the thing that's just weird about this film for me is that there's so many weird rules for magic.
Such as,
you never run from an immortal being; you walk from them because it doesn't attract their attention. You know, these are the guys that animated Lord of the Rings, but I would never just walk away from the Witch King of Angmar. But, you know. And then there's the funky things like, oh, she's a human now. If unicorns turn human, then they start to die. You know, and it's like a big deal. And I don't know. I just couldn't keep track of all these crazy, catch-22s and rules with magic. But apparently, some people can see unicorns and some people can't. That was also a little fuzzy for me.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure why that happened.
Maybe it's a loss of innocence. Kind of like, let's pull Peter Pan in here for a minute. You know, they say once you become an adult, you can't fly anymore and you can never journey to Neverland. Maybe that's what's happening here. Once you become an adult and lose your innocence and, you know, fall fate to the world, you can't see harpies or unicorns anymore.
Just those two. No mas.
That's what we see.
I love, okay, so she escapes. She decides to finally leave her forest for the first time ever because she's apparently the most obedient unicorn in the world and the only one who didn't leave the forest, and so she's protected. Everyone else just decided at one point in time to leave their forest, and they all get trapped in the sea. And then people see her and call her a mare, and she's like, mare, mare! I? A horse? Is that what you take me for? Is that what you see? I'm like, wow, there is...
So proud.
So, quite a hierarchy within the the horse realm, I guess, the equine universe. And
I know.
In My Little Pony, all of them are equal for the most part. A unicorn isn't better than a regular horse, but not here. Which, I agree, unicorns are cooler than regular horses anyway.
Yeah, they are.
Well, you know how these, you know, immortal creatures are pretty proud of themselves, you know?
Totally. They have right to be.
But do unicorns have, like, a job? Like, why do all the forest critters congregate when she leaves her forest? Like, it's, like, a big deal. Did she get them their food? Was she, like, a singer? Like, I don't get it.
Oh, in the book, they mention that no one dares hunt in a unicorn's wood. And usually unicorns, and if you want to look at mythology, they're always guarding some sort of pool. It's called a unicorn's pool. Ha ha! So they kind of do have jobs of protecting nature, if you want to interpret it that way.
Oh, the unicorn's pool.
It's supposed to be.
Okay, all right. Well, I get it. I get it. Okay.
I can go into the mythology about the unicorn's horn, too, if you'd like. I won't go into much detail, but there are legends about unicorns all over the world. The Chinese have one. The Japanese have one called a Kirin. But traditionally speaking, if we want to look at the pure medieval type, is that unicorn horns were able to heal any disease and prevent death. So what they used to do is they had unicorn hunts, and there's these beautiful tapestries called the Clunly Tapestries that depict the hunting of a unicorn. Basically, what they used to do was use a young maiden, a virgin, to lure a unicorn out, because unicorns are, of course, attracted to virgin maidens.
Nice.
And then they would use a net or a rope or something to catch the unicorn, and then they would trap it, and they would either kill it and then chop off the horn, or they would just domesticate the unicorn away, or they would just cop the unicorn's horn and maybe let it go. But either way, the unicorn isn't really in a good way at the end.
And then they would drink its silver blood?
Oh, no, you can't do that for the creature. You have slain a creature so pure that the one who drinks the blood lives a cursed life.
That's only in the Harry Potter universe.
Oh, yeah, come on, they're all the same now.
And when the centaur is like, a cursed life, a half-life, I'm like, Gordon Freeman! That's for Half-Life fans. But anyway, okay. You know, I would choose option three. I would get more returns on my investment if I just cut off the horn and let it go and let it grow back.
Let it go.
Let the unicorn go. Anyway, horses are cool. So there's a few people who want to capture her because they just think she's a pretty bay mare. There is one lady voiced by Angela Lansbury, an old crone, if you will, who does see her for who she is. And she runs a midnight circus, and that is, gosh, what is her name?
Mama Fortuna.
Yeah. So Mama Fortuna shows up with her crazy, kooky, midnight circus and captures the unicorn. And then we're introduced to the character that's actually with the unicorn the most through the film, which is Schmedrick, poor little guy.
Aww. He's cute.
I like Schmedrick.
I liked him a lot. He has a pure heart, so that's kind of why he's attracted to the unicorn, I think. And his voice totally reminds me of Hiccup. Did anyone else feel that?
I got some of that, too.
Kind of like this awkward kid is not living up to his potential, not that awesome. Yeah.
Awkward, yes, but I'm sure you mean Hiccup from How to Train Your Dragon 1.
Yes, I have not seen him in the second one.
It's not out yet.
I know.
Well, I mean, you've seen the trailers and stuff.
I know, but I can't judge until I see the whole thing.
Schmedberry is definitely awkward. And he's got the classic case of, my magic doesn't work the way I want it.
He comes from a long line of magicians, and so he's trying to live up to his family's reputation, but he's kind of just a bumbling fool. And if we want to go Yiddish, a Schmendrick in Yiddish is just kind of like a bumbler.
Well, that makes sense then. Okay, so she is forced to perform in this midnight circus, and all the creatures are actually not what they are. They're just illusion spells, which Mama Fortuna puts on him, except for one creature, which is the harpy. Now, I have fought harpies in the many RPGs that I've played on my computer. This harpy needs to put a shirt on, or three. This is when the film really started to show that it was not strictly a little kid's film.
Not at all.
A little awkward. But anyway, there's actually a few scenes in this. Anyway, so yeah, there's the harpy. I thought the harpy was going to be like the main antagonist, you know?
Yeah, kind she of just like plays the bad a small guy, part. You know?
I didn't understand the whole thing between Mama Fortuna and the harpy, that apparently everyone tells Mara Fortuna that she's going to get killed by this harpy because she captured it, but Mara Fortuna is, like, totally fine with it, you know, and when the harpy swoops down to kill her, Mama Fortuna's just like, rah, bring it on, YOLO, you know?
Yeah.
So, can anyone give me a little interpretation of that?
So, really, this was a lot to do with identity issues. Like, everybody calls Mama Fortuna this, you know, kind of the same thing as the bumbling idiot. Everyone just looks down on her as a witch, but now she says, well, they will see me. If nothing else, these characters, this unicorn and this harpy will know that it was I that caught them. And mm-hmm. So for her, it's this power thing of, I'm not really anything to anybody, but I at least will live on in this way. This is where I'm going to get my happiness, I guess you could say. And happiness is a huge theme in the movie, too, because later on it talks about, you know, are you happy? Well, men don't really know if they're really happy, but I guess I am. One funny thing I really liked about Mama Fortuna is it kind of reminded me of Rockadoodle, this one quote. Made me laugh. The unicorn is talking about the harpy to her, and she says, we are two sides of the same magic. Let her go. And the witch comes back and says, I'll quit show business first.
Pinky!
Pinky! That's all I could think about. It was, like, awesome. But, yeah, there's a lot of these just – she's got issues. Everybody's got their own issues going through this. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so I guess that's kind of her immortality. And maybe she's just like, oh, well, that harpy's going to get out anyway, so, you know, whatever. So anyway, okay, so Harpy gets out, and so does Unicorn. I don't know why the Unicorn lets the Harpy loose. Because Shredder was like, don't, it's going to get you, gosh!
I think she's going to eat me!
I think because the Unicorn understands the need for balance, kind of like, that there needs to be good and evil if we can classify the harpy as evil. And so she's not there to judge either way. She just knows that to be balanced, the harpy needs to be free. That's my feeling.
Wow. Very, very cool.
That's in there as well at the end too. Ah, there's a lot of these themes that come back around.
Yeah. And so it's now Shmedrick and the Unicorn on this epic quest. Do they know at this point that they need to go to King Haggard?
It's brought up, yeah. This is where they start heading over.
Yeah, and so then we're introduced to another main character, Molly, who I don't really know what her role is in the fellowship that forms, but I just think she just adds to everyone's bizarre reactions to the unicorn. Like, first they're like, whoa, it's a horse, I'll steal you. Oh, whoa, it's amazing. So the lady's like, I'm going to cry. Molly's like, damn you!
I want you!
I did not understand her reaction to the unicorn. Did she, like, know the unicorn?
Yeah. You want me to explain it, Mason?
Please do. Okay.
Do you remember how, when I was saying in a traditional unicorn hunt, how they needed a virgin maiden to catch and lure the unicorn out, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Molly Gru is kind of the fallen maiden. She makes a line that says, after all these years, you finally come to me. So she's accusing the unicorn of not coming to her. She's basically an older maiden, and she's basically an older maiden who's kind of fallen on her hard luck, and she's telling the unicorn, you should have come for me earlier when I was young and beautiful, but she fulfills the role of the virgin maiden. It kind of brings the fact of reality in. We don't have these princesses and princesses anymore. We have more real people like Molly Gru who've been hard on their luck.
See, I kind of see it as, you know, Molly, she also talks about how, you know, why didn't you come when I was clean and pure? You know, so honestly, I don't, she's probably not as, you know, she's probably.
She hasn't bathed, let's just say that. I'm just kidding. Okay, so she's not as pure as she once was.
Yeah. And,
okay, I get it. I just didn't understand why she was so, like, vindictive to the unicorn at first.
But I really like how at that point the unicorn just comes and says, well, I'm here now. And it's almost like she's giving her a new chance and kind of like a fresh start, a newness.
Yeah, better late than never, I suppose. Interesting, most interesting.
One of my favorite parts in this movie is when Schmendrick, he distracts that little henchman kind of dude, the flunky, and the flunky goes, Schmendrick, I get that. Why is a raven like a writing desk? And that's kind of an anachronistic reference to Alice in Wonderland, because that is the riddle from Alice in Wonderland. And the answer is even more anachronistic, because Poe wrote them both.
All right.
It's so punny.
Yikes.
I like it.
I tremble with fear. But anyway, Schmedrick does get into a few crazy situations. At first I thought it was like, oh, cool, like, you know, thief guy is, like, tying him to the tree that's on top of the ravine from Winnie the Pooh, you know, the 100-acre wood. Did anyone else think of that? Anyway. So he tries to get out by doing this enchantment, and things get really studio jiggling really fast. You know what I mean? My gosh.
I know what you mean. Great analogy.
First the harpy. Now this like amorous Douglas fir.
Oh no, I'm engaged to a Douglas fir.
It reminded me of the trees from Care Bears back in the 1980s.
Oh,
yeah, awesome. I wasn't much of a Care Bears guy.
You know, forest.
Were those as well endowed?
I don't think they had those in the Forest of Feelings.
Forest of Feelings? That's a real thing? Oh my goodness, we're going to have a Care Bears episode and invite Winnie.
And home is in your heart.
Yeah, so you get some good Schmedrick moments. My favorite line in the film is, the magic chose the shape, not I. I am a bearer. I am dwelling. I'm a messenger. And Molly's like, you are an idiot! This, of course, is right after Red Bull tries to chase Unicorn into the sea for reasons heretofore unknown until later on in the film. And then she actually gets changed into a maiden. This is one of those points where Schmedrick is like, magic, do as you will. So I guess this was something that was supposed to happen.
Yeah, you could look at it that way.
Or at least his enchantment went like, didn't backfire, you know, like Ron's wand in Harry Potter year two.
Boom!
Hey, that wasn't Ron's fault.
I know it wasn't, but, you know. First of all, the Red Bull. Is it like a real monster? Is it just kind of like real monsters? Is it just a kind of a conjuration by King Haggard?
I don't know. I've been debating over the Red Bull for years.
Really?
It could be that's how I spend my Saturdays, watching the best unicorn and just debating over it.
Hey, fair enough.
Yeah, I think there are my two favorite theories are is that it's another immortal who feeds off the power of maybe preying on other immortals, or my favorite theory is he's the manifestation of the end of this era, and he's one of the things that's driving the magic out, and his main target is unicorns by driving them into the sea.
Seems legit. Yeah, and so, okay, so he apparently only targets unicorns, not women. And so we get... What?
Remember the Clooney podcast?
Well, okay, here's the funny thing about him. Like, I believe that King Haggard is an interesting character because he spends his whole life really looking for outer elements to make him happy. And so at that one point, he decides and he realizes that the unicorn, looking upon the unicorn, makes me happy. I mean, I look at for whatever reason, the Harry Potter comes to mind, and the fact that unicorns are used as, you know, forever youth, you know? And I just feel like as he's standing there at the top of his little castle thing, I don't, have we gotten to this part yet?
Yeah, whatever. We can
yeah, work we haven't, it. We're just go back and forth. As he's standing up at the top of the turret of his castle, he's like, he just stares into the water, and it's almost like he's hypnotized by it, which he then loses his youth being hypnotized by this thing that he thinks makes him happy and wastes everything that he has. I don't know. It's just a weird thing. I haven't put my finger on what exactly this means, but it kind of does make me think of people who just, they really do just look for the things, other things to make them happy, but really it just corrodes, you know, they think that this will make me happy, but it just wastes their life. Like, you don't actually get any real fulfillment out of it.
So, first of all, what I don't get is what's so bad about the unicorn's human form? I mean, hello, she's like this anime babe. She looks great. She's the only attractive female in this whole movie.
Yeah, it's true. She's a goddess, basically, in human form.
Oh, there you go.
Well, I think that's why. It's because she is this immortal creature that's, like, near perfection, and then this is kind of just her being represented in human, and so she's very beautiful and lovely. But to her, it is the
more the more anime you are, the more perfect you are.
But to her, this is the worst fate that could ever befall a unicorn, and she'd rather die and throw herself. Yeah. So of course, all the humans around are like awkward. Like, I'm a human. I'm fine, you know. But talk about nudity. No problem. I mean, you don't see anything, but it's just like,
it's not
okay. Children, close your eyes.
Yeah, totally. It's nothing you haven't seen in Sailor Moon.
Okay, so I like this, because as I was thinking, it made me think of other movies where animals have human forms or humans have animal forms. So I was thinking of Casper, if that counts. I mean, he's a human who turns into a ghost, or vice versa. Hocus Pocus, Thackeray Binks, classic.
What's her name? Oh, who's the big boss lady on Spirited Away?
Yubaba.
Yubaba, yeah. She can turn into a raven-type creature.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Labyrinth. If we want to go the 1980s full fantasy, there's Labyrinth. Jareth turns into an owl. Lady Hawk, I mean, the whole movie revolves around Michelle Pfeiffer and the other dude transforming into animals. And then
the entire world should rightly revolve around Michelle Pfeiffer.
And then there's witches, where that little boy is turned into a mouse. And then there's Sabrina the Teenage Witch with Salem the Cat, who is a warlock who's been transformed into a cat as punishment for trying to take...
That's right.
I remember the episode where he, like, actually gets his body back for, like, a day. Oh, that was the coolest episode.
Yeah. And then, if we're going to go back to Miyazaki, we have Porco Rosso, a human who's been transformed into a pig. Howl's Moving Castle. Howl turns into that bird thingy. Pompoko, which is a movie about Japanese tanukis, a.k.a. raccoons, who are known to transform into whatever they feel like, and humans in this way. Again, Spirited Away, Mason mentioned, but the parents turn into pigs. And if we want to go Disney, Pinocchio, he turns into a real boy! And then he also turns into a donkey, or almost. And then there's any werewolf movie from Twilight all the way back to An American Werewolf in Paris.
Impressive.
All right, all right.
Most
impressive.
I got one more. Beauty and the Beast, and I'm talking about the...
How did we miss that one?
The Beast!
I'm talking French version, though, from the 1940s or 30s. Beautiful movie.
I'm thinking of the dog that turns into a sofa.
I'm thinking about the prince who turns into a beast.
Nah. Actually, I'm just thinking of Link's Awakening for Game Boy, where you have to sprinkle the magic powder on the raccoon, and it's actually that dude. Okay, if there is a single listener who knows what I'm talking about on the podcast, then send me a shout out on Twitter or on or whatchamacallit, the thing where you talk on the phone and it's a message. If you know what I'm talking about, send a voicemail or like find me on Twitter and do a shout out.
You'll get a retweet. Anywho. Let's just say that.
Oh yes, free RT for whoever. Anyway, again, you get this epic imagery. You know, they go to this dark and dreary castle. You know, the theme of isolation comes into play in this movie. The werewolf, the unicorn doesn't know if she's the last one. And then you got King Hagrid, who's just like, I know in the book there was like a little village before the castle, but in the movie it really makes it look like Hagrid just kind of lives alone, you know?
True. Hagrid, not Hagrid.
I said Hagrid.
Oh, I thought you said Hagrid.
Hagrid does sweet. Live alone, though.
He does. You call this a house?
So, talking about King Hagrid... He's insane. I mean, the poor unicorns. Why did he do that?
He's insane.
The, one of my favorite quotes actually comes right after they talk about the unicorns. And it's when they're going down into, they have to find the skeleton who talks and when the clock strikes the right time and all this, you know, mumbo jumbo. But my favorite quote that I always think of is the skeleton when he's just like, what is that? What is that you have over there? And he's like, oh, it's wine. Not like you would be able to taste it anyway. But he's like, but I remember. And for whatever reason, that one, that mental image is always in my head. But I remember. And it kind of, it does go deeper into illusions as well. Like, you see what you want to see. You think what you want to think, whether it's true or not.
All right, I get it. Yeah, and King Hagrid's just kind of this crazy. I mean, he is pretty crazy. Like, his whole motive behind, you know, forcing the unicorns into the ocean, apparently they're water breathers, so they're okay. You know, and trapping them there, it is very strange. You know, it's kind of like that thing where you, like, have to try, you try to preserve what makes you happy or preserve what you find pleasure in by any means possible, even if you lose your humanity in the process. And this is King Hagrid's character, definitely. I don't really know that much about him, just that he has a castle and that he sometimes dresses up as his own soldiers. So, and he's got this crazy castle and he's got this crazy, not so crazy son who's not really a son. And so I'm like, so what is this guy? Is he an old war hero? You know, is he really a king? You know?
Maybe he, I don't know, his backstory is never quite explained. I've always wondered if he's some guy who just popped up one day and says, I claim this castle in the name of Hagrid, and I shall be called King Hagrid. And it's just this dilapidated castle that no one wanted in the first place, and maybe they just decided to be kooky in the castle.
I think we're kind of, I don't know, I don't want to skip over Prince Lear or whatever his name is, you know, Jeff Bridges' character, but like, I don't know. He's kind of interesting. He's like the hero type, so he's like, hey, Lady Amalthea, I slayed this dragon for you. She's like, yawn, you know, and he's like, oh, so I shouldn't be a hero, so I should, like, turn to poetry and stuff. So I got this poem for you, you know? And, I don't know, it was kind of one of those, like, tragic love kind of things. But
completely tragic.
But then we start getting into how many songs there are in this film. There's just way, way too many songs, in my opinion, to the point where Jeff Bridges even tries his hand at the movie's soundtrack. And then Amalthea sings, and then, you know, there's nothing like a good old duet to bring a couple together, you know. A unicorn spirit, an immortal goddess lady who can't feel love, you know, she falls head over heels during the musical interlude, so... I thought that was like an interesting dynamic between the two, but it also kind of had these undertones of like never meant to be kind of thing.
Yeah, that's why I think I never really rooted for him, because I just always knew that this is never going to work out. So to me, there was no even like it wasn't believable.
He's a human. You're a unicorn. I consider myself a reasonable unicorn.
In the novel, Prince Lear's kind of a ladies' man. He first starts out engaged to this one maiden, and then when he sees Lady Amethelia, he breaks it off with her to be with the unicorn, and then at the end, do we want to head that far?
Or you want me to... Do we want to go there?
Yeah. At the end of the book, when the unicorn and him separate, Schmendrick and Molly Grew are walking away, and they see this maiden come up to them, and they're like, oh, yeah, there's this prince over here. Why don't you go over there to him? So he's never quite without a girl.
Yeah, so I don't know. Prince Lear, whatever. But it's kind of one of those not meant to be kind of things. And so they kind of get, okay, so we don't know how long they're at this castle. My goodness, poor Schmedrick having to do card tricks and juggling for this king who was probably a very tough crowd. My goodness. And so, okay, they got past the skeleton and the pirate cat, who I think is awesome, and I think the pirate cat needs his own film.
Yes, please. I like
the pirate cat. I want pirate cat. Like, I be what a cat, I be what I be.
He needed his own spin-off cartoon show.
I escaped with nothing but me beard. But anyway, a little Lego movie for you. I want Pirate Cat. That is the most interesting character in this film. But anyway, I wish Pirate Cat had gone with them. What happened to Pirate Cat when the castle... Oh, I can't even think about it. Poor Kitty.
He knew what was coming, so he left. He hightailed it out of there.
He hopped on the back of a unicorn and went away into the Forbidden Forest.
Unicorn. The Forest of Feelings. Now, so we kind of have the showdown with Red Bull. It's like, okay, we've got to find the unicorns. Oh my gosh, Red Bull's right there! You know, and so Red Bull is like, all right, here it comes. I'm going to get you this time. Some point, the unicorn, Lady Amethelia, turns back into a unicorn. I can't remember, but at some point she turns back, right? And that's what sets the Red Bull off?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. So, in the cave, the Red Bull knows that she is a unicorn, even in her human state. And so, they have to change her back into a unicorn. And so, as she does... It's really interesting because, like, in this whole fight, there's a fight that goes on in the cave before they actually change her. And it just goes back and forth between, like, why aren't there any... Let her be stay a unicorn, you know, or let her stay a
That's
human,
right.
And they'll be happy ever after. And, like, why aren't there ever any happy endings? And then Schmiedrich said, it's because there are no happy endings because there is no end. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting.
Deep.
Right? And later...
Trippy, man.
And later on, and after she is a unicorn, Molly Crew comes back and she says, what is magic for if you can't save a unicorn? And then Schmiedrich comes back, that's what heroes are for. And then, I don't know, there's... Oh. I loved Prince Lear. Yeah, yeah, that is what heroes are for. Just like pushes him aside.
I like football. Yeah. But, I don't know. All of a sudden, Schmedrick has like all the answers, and it's really weird.
He does. I think he always did have all the answers, because at the beginning, he talks about how Mama Fortuna just thinks I'm a babbling idiot, but, you know, I can see all this. So I think he really does have all the answers. He's just... doesn't know he has all the answers or so. I don't know. But this kind of goes back into my whole, you know, looking at this on the other level of, like, what are heroes? Is magic kind of like disguises while heroism is reality? I don't know. So what do you guys think?
When I'm looking at this, the end of this movie, I kind of think of it as a paradox. Remember when Schmendrick says that he's just more of a conduit for the magic and the magic takes its form whatever he wants it to. Well, I kind of think maybe the magic turned the unicorn into a human because the magic knew that it needed the Red Bull to be defeated. And without the unicorn, but the Red Bull could not be defeated unless the unicorn felt love and thus has something to fight for. So, in effect, she was turned into a human. The Red Bull is defeated. So if she had never turned into a human, she would have just joined the other unicorns in the sea, or she would have never maybe have even left her forest.
I see that. Well, and then also, when the unicorn does go and she fights back against the Red Bull, like, maybe the Red Bull is, you know, you could use that as fear. And then I heard this, what is it where you take the first letters of each word and make another word? What is that called?
Oh my gosh, it's completely, I can't remember, acronym?
Yeah.
Acronym, sorry, I was saying acronym like five times, but my mic was
shit. Sure, Mason.
No, I was.
There was this acronym I remember hearing about fear, saying false evidence appearing real. And so I'm like, ooh, that kind of could be this whole theme of this movie too. So anyway, those are deep thoughts with Chelsea.
Deep thoughts indeed, bro. Well, cool. I appreciate those deep thoughts. So yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Whole thing where it's like, oh, why don't you just like stay anime girl and hang out with Clear forever, because he loves you, obviously. But I guess things had to be the way they had to be, and so all the unicorns are free. You know, they're whoosh, they come out of the sea, and King Haggard is like, no, you know, and you know, he's gone. That was his castle. And so we get into this weird ending, definitely a little melancholy, because Lear doesn't really get to be with Unicorn Lady anymore. You know, he's kind of just like, all right, see you later, you know? At least Schmedrick still gets to hang out with Molly. I think they kind of hit it off in this movie. Is that how it's supposed to be? I mean,
well, they do end up together, don't they?
Well, they do. You know, but it's not like, I don't know, it's not like everyone gets what they want, and even the unicorn is like, well, that was all really exciting and all, but I'm still kind of alone, but there's other unicorns. Now I know what I set out to figure out, and, you know, it's, I'm sad because everything has happened, but I also figured out what love is. Is, you know, I want to know what love is. Bee, 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 bee. Anyway, so like no one really, I don't know. Everybody kind of gets what they want, but except for Prince Lear. So I don't know. I was just kind of it wasn't like a letdown, but it was just kind of a huh kind of thing for me.
Well, maybe the going with my theory of the unicorn needed to feel love in order to defeat the Red Bull. Maybe the magic, figured out that the world is changing from magic to technology or science or whatever you want to call it, and knew that the immortals had to adapt. But since they're basically static creatures, they can't do it. So in essence, the unicorn has evolved from the magic by learning what love is.
Well, all right.
There you have it, everybody.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it, definitely. So, I mean, that's... I don't know what to take away from this film. One thing that was, like, a big factor of annoyance for me was the music in this film. I'm probably the only person out of this quattro that that feels like this. But I just feel like the music was... Okay, I don't want to sound so negative, but the music was very interesting. I think there was a lot of it. In fact, I think there was like maybe 30 seconds at one point between two songs. lots of montage songs, very, very Simon and Garfunkel interlude songs, you know, where, I thought these songs were like, oh, okay, that's just kind of funky songs from the radio. But no, they literally wrote a 70s style song about being the last unicorn. Is there like a cassette tape somewhere where I can listen to this song in the car? There's
actually an interesting story about the soundtrack.
Let's hear it.
It was never released on an official LP back in the 1982, so people had a hard time tracking it down until recent years.
Ooh, nice.
There is a Concert of America, the band, singing this song for a live audience, and I was just like, oh, nice. But, yeah, they're actually really hugely famous for the song I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. That good to be out on the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name. You know, it's very strange lyrics, but it works out perfectly with this very strange story, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think I think that's one of the reasons why they did put them together. It was like, oh, you guys fit really weird with you guys fit really great with this very abstract material.
Well, I will admit that that particular music group was like perfect for this movie.
At first, I didn't like the music. The very first song, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is happening. And then as the songs kept happening, it kind of grew on me, and it seemed like I couldn't have this movie without the songs. So in the end, I appreciated the songs and thought they fit, but at the very beginning, it kind of shocked me.
I mean, I loved the songs as a child, but then as I rewatched it as an adult, I was like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. I like the American songs, but when we hear any other people but America sing, I just shudder.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges and Mia is interesting. Very interesting.
That is true. When I think of the songs I only listen to the America songs. I kind of just ignore the fact that the other characters sing.
Dude. Jeff Bridges' sappy falsetto is unforgettable, and I think we can all agree with that.
Or, how about Mia Farrow, now that I'm a woman? Oh, my God.
Whoa, yeah.
Oh, God.
Interesting.
I'm like Animal on the Muppets. Woman!
Anyway. So... And as probably many of you have noticed as I've studied this movie quite a lot over the years because it just seems to pop up my radar whenever I start thinking about it. A few years ago when I was starting to try to locate a DVD copy of it, I learned that The Last Unicorn has acquired quite the cult following. So, of course, they want to have a DVD about it. Peter S. Beagle, he really approved of the movie. But however, when the DVD was released in 2004, I have to admit, it was really bad quality. The sound was horrible. The picture was not even up to HD. And so Peter S. Beagle, the author, he asked Lionsgate, the distributor, to redistribute the movie in a better quality. And Lionsgate actually listened to him, and they released the 25th anniversary edition. But the problem was, is those were just the beginning of Peter's woe. Due to some legalese, he didn't get any proceeds from third sellers of the DVD. So if you bought this on Amazon back around that time, Peter got zip. And this was extreme. I know. I was stunned at that. And that was extremely unfair. I mean, consider that Peter created the source material and he was so involved in the movie. Thankfully, however, Peter and Lionsgate were able to strike a deal, and it was a very special deal where Peter received half of the sales of if the DVD was purchased directly from his own company called Conlon Press. What is wonderful about buying the DVD directly from him is you can only buy one of two versions. One is where he signs it, and another is where he's personalized it. So either way, you're getting a DVD of The Last Unicorn signed by Peter S. Beagle. I personally got my DVD from there, and also some really great quality art prints from one of the character designers, Hideo Kubo, on the movie. And Peter signed all of them. At the beginning of this podcast, Zora mentioned that Peter is also touring the country. So Peter and his manager, Connor Cochran, they're really nice people, and they've planned to tour the U.S. and other countries up until mid-2015 in the worldwide Last Unicorn tour. They're appearing at conventions and movie theaters, and these appearances also include a free book signing and a screen of the movie with commentary from Peter. There's more information on the tour dates up at conlonpress.com, but if you want Peter to appear at your city or place near you, spread the word at a local venue. I met him at Dragon Con, and they did a special showing of the movie, and it was just great being able to experience that. Also, if you can't make one of the tour dates, we plan on asking Peter and Connor Cochran, his manager, to be a guest on Animation Interviews in the near future. We are still ironing out the details, but we hope that they will be guests.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So I will include those links in the show notes. So these links aren't going to be for our normal Amazon links. They're going to be directly the links to Conlon Press. So that way Peter can actually get some credit for his movie and source material because it's really fabulous. And I definitely think that the creators should be rewarded for their work. So if you want to buy the movie, you can buy the Blu-ray and DVD on his site. And obviously it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but like Whitney mentioned, you get, you know, personalized and signed. So actually it's not that much more expensive. The DVD signed is $15, $25 personalized. Blu-ray is $20 signed and $30 personalized. So really there is no reason why you shouldn't buy it from him because you get some cool perks. Okay, so we asked our listeners what they would rate The Last Unicorn and why. And Suzanne said, 5 out of 5, love the soundtrack and the more serious undertone. It's beautiful, dark, and romantic. The only downside is that the crazy tree that's in love with Schmendrick, that scene always seemed out of place and just awkward.
So awkward.
Fadi Antoine says, The Last Unicorn episode? But you can't stop now. I want more unicorn episodes. Please make more. Sorry. That is the final episode we're ever going to do about unicorns. So this is it. Okay? We're not doing any more unicorns. It's the last.
Unless you do something on Unico.
Yeah. No. I just told them this is the last one we're ever doing. Just kidding.
And she's holding to it.
No more unicorns. Okay. So Ashley Shadowbrook says, Lion King and now this? Oh, my childhood. 5 out of 5. Not many movies have replay value for me, but I can still watch it over and over. And lastly, Kenneth Smith said, always enjoyed the character designs from Rankin Bass Studios. Okay, guys, what do you guys rate the movie?
Okay, here's Mason's rating on The Last Unicorn. I think it's an interesting film, and there's some, like, cool characters and stuff. Like, I can't get more than, like, a 2.5-star rating.
What?
I'm sorry if there are listeners that are like throwing things at their audio devices right now. But yeah, 2.5 stars. Like I mean, there's some cool parts in this film, and I do appreciate the medieval epic thing, and there's some cool symbolism. But like, I don't know, the movie's just never really came together for me. Not very like cohesive, and I know that part of the reason is that it's so old, but I just had a really hard time kind of connecting to this film, and getting through it was kind of tedious. But it doesn't mean it was a horrible film. Like, a horrible film would be like a 1 star, you know. 2.5 stars is respectable. So yeah, that'd be the rating I'd give The Last Unicorn. Yeah.
All right, I actually kind of agreed to some extent. You'll be very surprised about this, but I did agree with Mason a little bit on his rating of the film as being a little bit lower, but only at a certain time when I first watched this movie. So when I watched it as a kid, I thought it was really cool. I was like, this movie's awesome for whatever reason. I don't know why. But then that time when you and I watched it, Morgan, I just remember thinking, what in the world did I just get her into? I don't know what this is. I'm pretty sure it happened around the butterfly. And the butfly just was like, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. What is this? And yes, the Douglas fir kind of probably tipped that off too. But then watching it this time, my steam for the movie shot back up because I realized the deeper levels of it. And I like a movie that makes me think. So That's why I give this one 4 stars.
I agree. I give it 4 stars. I personally really like the medieval fantasy aspect of it, and I think Rankin Bass does that pretty well. I mean, just because they did Lord of the Rings, and it sort of seems to be a unique style for them. And the story is simple, but it's dark in a way that I don't see a lot of animated movies being. And I think that's why it appeals to so many people, especially a lot of people who watch this when they were children. I think the fact that it is so different from what Disney was at the time and a lot of other animated films, that it just really captivated them. And I really enjoyed this movie watching it, and I was glad that I was able to. But 4 stars.
I am going to make this a triad. I also give this movie 4 stars. I don't think it's perfection, but I think for its time, that this was probably one of the best made movies in the 1980s, considering that this was the start of the Disney dark era, I like to call it, when a lot of those movies weren't that great. And just the story, because it touches on a lot of more mature themes that you're not going to get into a lot of animated movies. And also, I love the animation movie. This is pre-Studio Ghibli. There's such a lovely amount to detail that the Japanese artists can only really do, and that was missing a lot of animation. I mean, in animation of that time. I mean, of course, studios have been able to capture that essence since then, but you really just don't get it. And I think it's a product of its time, especially with the music, which I'm not a big fan of, but you're not going to get this type of animation ever again. And I love the story, so yep, there we go.
I've had time to write a book about the way you act and look. I haven't got a paragraph. Words are always getting in my way. Anyway, I love you. That's all I have to tell you. That's all I've got to say.
All right, we're moving into our mailbag, so I'm going to start with our first email from Luis. He says, just thought I'd let you know that I listened to episode 58 on Cats Don't Dance, and I love it. I love that movie. It's so underrated. And though I'm not one to be big on animated musicals, I like the music in this movie. I have a folder of Cats Don't Dance animation at home. It has model sheets and flippable animation scenes. I love studying it and looking through that stuff. It's a fun, fun movie. I'm so glad you highlighted it. Did you know that Gene Kelly consulted on the choreography of the movie? It was his last film project. So awesome. I love Gene Kelly. Mason, I don't mean to pick on you, dude, but you totally lose animation fandom points for not knowing who Chilly Willy the Penguin is, especially since Tex Avery was involved in making the characters popular. And you know who Tex is, right? You totally gained some said animation fandom points back by being a fan of the Batman animated series. I also think that you should talk about those superhero Warner Brothers movies more. Especially since I think that division of Warner Brothers Animation is the only American animation studio catering to teen and adult males, like 13 to 40-year-old males. Which is perhaps the reason why these cartoons might not be in Morgan and Chelsea's radar. I'm thinking Batman Under the Red Hood and All-Star Superman don't sound like they were meant to be a female demographic. Although, my wife liked both of these movies just fine. I've written two lists on my blog pointing out the top 10 best animated superhero movies and the top 10 best animated superhero TV shows, if you're curious. Oh, and I have my list of top 10 Disney movies if you're curious to see what my taste in Disney movies is like. What are your guys' top 10? Do you count Pixar movies in there, or do you count them separate, like I did? Anyway, great show. So glad you made people aware of Cats Don't Dance, and keep up the great work, Luis.
Luis is a fantastic guy. He's actually been an animator over at The Simpsons for the past 20 years, and I've been following his blog for a couple years now. Really, really cool things. We're going to definitely put these different posts that he's put in this letter on the show notes, so check those out if you want to go see more of his stuff. But yeah, I have not made a top 10 list. Have you guys?
I have ish. It keeps changing, but want me to give it a whirl?
Sure.
Okay. So let me count them off here. 101 Dalmatians, Mulan, Lion King, Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid, that brings me up to 4. Sleeping Beauty, Peter Pan, Jungle Book, Lilo and Stitch. I'm not going to count Dinosaur, even though I like the animation in that. Gosh, I love Robin Hood and then The Sword and the Stone. I know that probably is not the most favorite of everybody's, but I don't know, I like the Xerox copy era a little bit.
Awesome. I don't have a top 10 list, but one thing I know for sure is that I don't count Pixar as Disney. So my list, if I were just to think of favorites off the top of my head, although I'll have to go and like really make a list of these, rank the all the Disney animated films 1 through 53. But I would definitely say Aladdin is up there, Beauty and the Beast, 101 Dalmatians, Pinocchio, of course. I kind of want to throw Hercules in there because I really like it, but I think that's more of just me. Yeah, so I'll definitely have to make that list. That's a good idea. And I'm going to check out Luisa's list as well.
I'm going to change one of mine to Hercules. I love that movie.
So good.
I know.
Hey, that's what we're doing in 2 episodes. That's part of our horse series.
Apology.
All right, our next animation email is from David Lee. And he says, first off, I love the podcast. I came across your site one day while looking up Disney concept art, and ever since I've been binge listening on all of your reviews. My favorite so far has been the Goofy movie one. I think it's because that's usually considered such an obscure Disney movie, and to hear all of you quote it word for word is just hilarious. To top it off, Chelsea, yodeling the possum song, and you have won me over completely. Well, I'm so glad. I also love hearing about Mason and his epic journey to becoming an animator. At the moment, I'm a self-taught artist, but I'm hoping to start school sometime in the coming summer. I've attached a drawing of Elsa of mine from my DeviantArt account and would love if you could let me know what you think about it, either through email or on the podcast. I would really appreciate the boost. My DeviantArt name is FUHRMANECK66. Love you guys and stay animated. And then he gives his picture, which I think is really cool. Has a very different take on Elsa, I would say, than what you're seeing out there a lot now.
Mm-hmm. It has a very good comic book style to it. It's very animated in the image that it is now. It kind of reminds me of Avatar style, but there are some Disney elements in there. I mean, I would love to see that just reading a book.
Okay, so the next one is from Georgiana. She says, hi guys, I only found your show the other day despite being a constant user of Hypeable, and I just want to tell you how awesome your podcast is. I love animation, although not previously as deeply as you all, and the range of reviews and analysis you provide show how broad of a category animation is. The fact that you are Disney nerds as well as being able to dissect the cinematography of the films is great to listen to, and I always find myself being pulled into your discussions. Best wishes, Georgiana, age 16, the UK. Aw, thanks, Georgiana. Yes, that's one place you can find us, everybody, is Hypeable.com. Hypeable is incredible. They're basically the go-to place for any fandom that you're involved in, and, you know, if animation is that, you can find our podcast there. But thanks for your kind words, Georgiana.
Hey, guys! My name is Adriana, and I would like to share my thoughts on Frozen. The only reason I ever knew about Frozen was because of you guys, and I would like to thank you so much for promoting the movie, even when Disney wasn't. Frozen is now one of my favorite movies of all time. The animation is some of the best I have ever seen. The snow effects are dazzling. The dialogue is funny and quotable. And the songs were memorable and catchy. I actually went and bought the soundtrack, which I have never done for a movie before. The character designs are overall good. But I didn't really care for Olaf's design or the background character designs because they all looked the same. Speaking of the background characters, I didn't really notice how stiff they were until my second and third viewing of the movie. But they certainly aren't the worst background characters in a Disney movie. That would have to be the background characters in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. The only major problem I have with the movie is the song In Summer because it just stops the plot. Overall, I would give the movie 4.5 stars out of 5. While listening to the various podcasts of yours, I have noticed that a lot of people like Tangled more than Frozen. But I have to disagree because the character designs in Tangled sometimes felt off and really annoyed me, like Flynn's weird bangs or Rapunzel's tennis ball eyes and beaver teeth. Another thing that felt off in Tangled was the voice actors. Not Mandy Moore or Donna Murphy's voice, but Zachary Levi's and the background characters' voices didn't always work with the character designs. With Frozen, I felt like the voices fit the character designs, and I really don't care for Tangled's music, but that's just me. When I went to see the movie the second time, I brought my very cynical friend who usually hates animated movies, but even she loved it. I've also noticed that at school, everyone has been talking about Frozen. Not just the girls, but the boys as well, which is very unusual for an animated Disney princess movie. I guess Disney's marketing didn't work for them. It did work for them in the end. What I'm trying to say is that I think this movie is destined to become a classic because it can reach everyone on an emotional level. The Walt Disney Animation Studios are just releasing better and better movies each year. I can't wait for Big Hero 6. Sorry this email is so long, but I just want to get my thoughts out there. Sincerely, Adriana. All right, Adriana, no long emails are okay. We love them because, frankly, they stroke our ego. No, let me say that. Because, frankly, they make us glad that we have listeners who like listening to the podcast. But also, we like to hear viewers' thoughts as well. Guys, what do you guys think about Frozen? What would you give it the rating?
I completely agree. I gave it 4.5, so I think Adriana's rating is right on target. I think there were a few things that just didn't make it a 5-star for me. Come back and ask me in 10 years and we'll see if that changes. But 4.5, which is really, really good.
With cost and viewing, like the first time I saw it, I definitely gave it a 4.5 stars. And with more views, every time I see more from this movie, I tend to like it more. I still give it 4.5 stars. But it's starting to grow on me even more. The whole cast, the whole story, even the random YouTube covers, I'm totally a fan of. So I just really like Frozen.
I give it a 4. Some of the pacing issues, I mean, don't get me wrong, people, I love Frozen, but there are some pacing issues, and then one moment they're all in song, and then the next they're speaking, and then the next they're just talking in song. That kind of got me, and I think Olaf was just thrown in there to be a cute little mascot. And I mean, I like Olaf, but it just didn't really, like, eh. But I like it. Let it go.
Let it go. Hey guys, first off, thank you so much for answering my questions about character backstory in your Cats Don't Dance podcast. Your Lion King podcast was great, but what did you think about the spin-off TV series Timon and Pumbaa? I personally was disappointed that the rest of the film's characters rarely appeared, if at all. The show's tone was also far goofier than The Lion King 1.5. By the way, if you ever find yourself at Walt Disney World, check out the beautifully executed 4D CGI version of I Just Can't Wait to Be King at Mickey's PhilharMagic. Hakuna Matata, and long live the king, your friend Mike. Thanks, Mike. Definitely, I saw Timon and Pumbaa growing up, but only a few times. I'm pretty sure it was on the tail end of the Disney Afternoon period.
I didn't like Timon and Pumbaa. I didn't like the animation style. I didn't like Simba and Nala weren't around. And yeah, I'm glad that I had the original voice actors. But then there's the issue of canon with me. Because in Timon and Pumbaa, they explained Timon and Pumbaa's origins a bit more. And then Lion King 1.5 came out, and it didn't even refer to Timon and Pumbaa. So then we got this whole multiverse thing going on, and I'm like, which is real, which isn't? I'm all confused now.
Yeah, I knew that this existed, but I never watched it. It didn't appeal to me. At this point, there had been 2 or 3 spin-off movies, and they just weren't so great. So I just avoided Timon and Pumbaa. All right, last email says, Dear Chelsea, Morgan, and Mason, hi guys, enjoy listening to your show. I was thinking of an idea for an animated film and I wanted to share the ideas with you. I was thinking about a 2D and 3D film that a 2D character goes into a 3D world and a 3D character goes into a 2D world. The reason why I thought this idea is because people argue about whether 3D or 2D is better. The 2D character will have to learn about the 3D world and the 3D character will have to learn about the 2D world. At the end of the film, they both understand why they are both in certain worlds and learn that who they are is the most important thing. But I was thinking, who would be the character in the 2D world and who would be the 3D character? And the film would have to focus on each of the characters in the same amount of time. I was thinking of this idea because I think people should know the qualities of both 2D and 3D. At the end of the film, they could actually learn something about 2D and 3D. I'm not a filmmaker and animator, but I just thought of this idea and I hope you like it. So take care, guys, and good luck with the podcast. Keep up the great work. Mark. You know, that actually reminds me a bit of Enchanted, because in Enchanted, Giselle is a 2D character, and with that, all the flatness of a 2D personality, and then she kind of moves, not really into a 3D world, but to a real-life 3D world, I guess you would say. It's not animation, but, and then she learns to appreciate that world, and she actually stays in that world. But this idea that you're talking about, I think it'd be really cool, because I think actually a lot of people are always, you know, the purists are saying, oh, it should be a 2D animated film. Why aren't they doing this 2D? So this way you could probably satisfy both sides. You get your 2D fix, and then, you know, half the film's 3D.
I thought it totally reminded me of Get a Horse. So when I was reading this the first time, I was like, oh, it's like in Get a Horse, how they go back and forth from 2D to 3D.
This actually happened with the Fairly Odd Parents and Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius. They had a crossover series. They had a crossover movie a few years ago where Timmy Turner from Fairly Odd Parents zapped himself into Jimmy Neutron's Boy Genius's universe, and then Jimmy Neutron was sucked into Timmy Turner's universe, and they kind of battle it out, and it was fun to see.
Nice.
When the last moon is cast over the last star of morning, and the future has passed without even a last desperate warning, then look into the sky where through the clouds of happiness.
All right, guys, thanks for listening to our show and our review of Rankin Bass's The Last Unicorn. And thank you very much to Whitney for joining us today. I had a blast, and I'm really excited that we got to have Whitney on the show and to hear her fun side and all of her opinions on The Last Unicorn.
Well, thank you. I was glad to be here. I was very honored. This was a lot of fun.
For show notes on this episode, you can head on over to rotoscopers.com/61. Also, you can find us on Hypeable and animatedviews.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, people, please. This is definitely a way to help us get a little bit more recognition on iTunes, for sure. But also, it's an easy way to make sure that you are never that far behind on your Animation Addicts podcasts. They can update automatically. It's great. You can also find us on Stitcher Radio. And once again, if you're on either of those, send feedback on iTunes and Stitcher. We really appreciate it. You can email us at therotoscopers@gmail.com. Also, please, voicemails are awesome. I miss hearing your voices. It makes me feel like you're real people when I can hear your voices. So head on over to rotoscopers.com/voicemail. Or you can give us a call at 406-646-6575. An easy way to contact us also is just to head on over to rotoscopers.com/contact.
And of course, be sure to use our affiliate links. You can go to rotoscopers.com/Amazon, and anything you purchase there goes to support the show. A bit of proceeds of it supports the show, and we really, really appreciate it more than you know. So if you are an Amazon shopper, just go to rotoscopers.com/Amazon and save that as your Amazon bookmark on your browser, and you just click it, and every time you make a purchase, a little bit goes to us, and we love you so much for it. And then, of course, go to rotoscopers.com/Audible, and that's where you can get a free audiobook. I think, actually, the audiobook of The Last Unicorn would be a perfect book to download and listen to. That way you can get the more robust story, what Peter S. Beagle actually wrote, which was then adapted into the movie. And so I think definitely check that book out. And of course, next episode we are going to be doing Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron by DreamWorks. So send in those emails. Just make sure to send us your emails, voicemails, and we will read them on the next show. And you can find us on our individual locations. I'm at Morgan Stradling on Twitter. Chelsea's at Chelsea Robson on Twitter. You can also go to chelsearobson.com. Mason is MasonMSTX on Twitter, and you can also go to his blog, which is thisanimatedlife.blogspot.com. And then our fabulous co-host and guest, Whitney Grace, you can find her on Twitter at StorySequence. She's also the host of the Animated Interviews podcast, so just go to animatedinterviews.com, and you'll find all of her interviews there. And of course, she's a writer on Animated Views. All right, guys, thanks for listening, and until next time,
we are the Rotoscopers.
And then as I was thinking, of course, my mind turns to procreation. That sounds so bad. But I was thinking, okay, because she talks about...
Of course it does. Unicorns are like... what? Are you laughing because of the way I say unicorn?
Yes.
I'm using the old English way of saying unicorn. All right, if unicorns live forever... how do they procreate? That's a toughie. That's a toughie right there. Sorry, whenever I hear Molly Gru, I think of Motley Crue. And, but anyway.
In post-editing, we make it a bit higher. We don't know why he just requests it.
Well, it helps me appeal more to 13-year-old girls.
This guy sounds like he's 16 instead of 25.
Ooh, I want to marry Mason.
Sorry, ladies.
All right, shall we get started?
I really hope you recorded that little bit. That was fun.
I did.
Okay, good.
Oh, great. Now Mason's a pedophile.
Give us more pirate cats.